Today is Sunday, February 26th, 2023. This is part 3 of a Grand Canyon oral history with Richard "Tick" Segerblum. And Segerblum is spelled S-E-G-E-R-B-L-O-M. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Tick. How are you today?
Good.
Great. Glad to hear it. Tick, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Tick, last time you mentioned you were going to school out in California, going to college, and you ended up doing a river trip, I think, in the summer of 69. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how it happened. I think my parents, I don't think it was a one of my dad's art trips, although it could have been. But anyway, I got invited to go on the trip, but I'm pretty sure my parents were on the trip too. It was my first trip to the Grand Canyon since 63, and the first one with the new technology, the big rafts and everything. So it was a 10-day trip and real eye-opener for me.
What do you remember that? Now, this is 1969. The dam started impounding water in a big way with the closing of the bypass tubes in January of 1963. So by 1969, do you remember what kind of flows they were releasing? Were your boats like high and dry in the morning and or, you know, was there a tide going through the canyon every day at that time?
You know, I honestly don't remember that part.
Okay.
I remember at some point, and it was probably because I didn't go on another Grand Canyon for a long time, so that's probably, I do kind of remember that they used to worry about, you know, how the boat was hooked up, and so that you'd have to let it down if the water was going to go down, or be prepared if the water was going to come up.
Okay. And then, do you remember your drinking water? Was that like, here's a cup and there's the river? Or was it more complex than that?
I don't. I think they probably dropped iodine or whatever they used to put in there just to make it. But it was not, you know, we were certainly welcome to drink water out of the river. And that was all the river trips I did, we always drank. It was personally, I drank from the river.
Okay. And then were the meals being cooked on open fires right on the beach?
Yeah, and there was still a lot of driftwood. So
okay,
there was a ton of driftwood everywhere, and so that was the way it all worked.
And then, do you remember the bathroom situation? How did that work?
You know, I don't even know that we had porta potties or ammo cans or anything.
Just a roll of toilet paper and one gender.
Upstream and downstream, as I recall. But
yep.
I'm not sure.
All right. Do you remember who was on that trip? Now, you mentioned your dad might have been doing art trips. What were those all about?
He and I'm not sure when this started, but because he and Bill were very close, and Bill, you know, was reaching out to try to expand the business. They did a thing where my father would through the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, UNLV, would teach a summer school course, and so you get credit through, I'm not sure how much credit you get, but anyway, he would teach watercolor on the river.
Oh, wow.
And they taught like, I'm not sure if they'd have like 20 students or so, but anyway, it was every day they would either, before noon or afterwards, they would spend a couple hours, just stop somewhere where they would paint pictures, paint paintings.
Huh. What a neat idea.
Yeah, I have a lot of those paintings that he did anyway, at least on slides. I don't have all. I have a few from just what he painted, but mm-hmm. Most of them are slides of what he painted.
Cool. And what was Bill's connection with the river? How did that, do you know how that came together?
I don't. Somehow or other, he and Ron, you know, Bill was a photographer for the National Geographic, and I know they had hired, I don't think hired Ron, or they just used Ron for a National Geographic, something or other deal with the National Geographic. So I think that's probably how they, Bill and Ron hooked up. But at some point in the late 60s, they've become partners at some, I'm not sure what level, but they were worked in their office in Salt Lake. And
so did the Belknaps, that's Bill Belknap, B-E-L-K-N-A-P, did the Belknaps then move out of Boulder City to Salt Lake?
They did. I mean, they still had their house in Boulder City, but they had an apartment that they, or a duplex that they rented.
Oh, okay.
And when I would go there, I would stay there.
All right. And why was the business being run out of Salt Lake City? That seems a long ways away from Grand Canyon.
I think that's where Western was based. I think everybody was based out of Salt Lake at that time.
Okay. Just the place to be.
And Hatch, I'm not sure where Hatch was. And Hatch may have been based out of Pearl, but
right.
No one thought to base it in Flagstaff or Kanab, I would think. But
well, was and this is Ron Smith, is that right?
Right.
And was Ron running other rivers at the time, or was your dad running other rivers?
No, my dad did. He just did this. I mean, well, it started with at the Grand Canyon. That later on, they did Lador, they did Canyonlands, and they did Green River trips.
Okay, so that kind of makes a little more sense to be out of Salt Lake if you're doing upper basin stuff as well.
Yeah, and I'm not sure the way it always worked when I got involved. I'm not sure when it started, but you would always do the Yampa or Dolores in first in the spring, and then you would go down to Cataract and do Cataract, and then you'd go to the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
So when was it? So at some point they established Canyonlands Expedition, a separate company based out of Green River. But I think that may have been the summer of 71. Maybe it could have been the summer of 72, because I was riding the river and right before, up until I went to law school.
Okay. And were Ron and Bill still partners at that time, or did that...
They were. I'm not sure when they broke up, but they were still partners.
Okay.
But I think the first sport yacht trip would have been in the summer of 70, summer of 70. And that was down, all the sport yacht trips. Well, I shouldn't say I think the sport yacht trips were always just in Desolation.
Okay.
And that was revolutionary, because that was Bill's little thing, and that was the first time that Ron had ever had, or anybody probably had, a commercial trip where you could individually buy a ticket and have your own boat.
Nice. And were those popular?
They were. I mean, they had to reach out to a lot of different interest groups, and I'm not sure they made any money because they probably didn't charge very much.
Mm-hmm.
But they had, you know, I'm not sure, 6 or 8 trips a summer.
Oh, wow. Okay. What do you remember, what else do you remember about that 1969 river trip? Was that with Grand Canyon Expeditions, GCE?
Yeah, that was Grand Canyon Expeditions, I just remember, you know, it was new to me to be on these big rafts and all the stuff they did as far as the fancy food and the beer, and I mean, it was a whole other world compared to what I'd seen before.
Huh. Do you remember who the boatmen were on that trip?
I do. Well, I shouldn't say that. I think I do. but I think that's when I first met Pete Gibbs. We were just talking about, I can't think of Waterman's first name, and Art Gallinson. And so there may have been four boats, or maybe Ron didn't run a boat, but I'm pretty sure that Waterman and Art and Pete were the boatmen, or some of the boatmen.
Okay.
Which were, you know, at the time, I don't know if they were legends, but they were, you know, big-time boatmen. And I think, in retrospect, at this point, they're probably legends at some level.
What do you remember about them?
Just, you know, normal kind of people. I mean, they had different backgrounds. They were, I think Pete was a mountain climber, and I'm not sure they were all kind of out of Salt Lake. Art, the thing I remember about Art was Art didn't know how to swim, so it was kind of strange to be a boatman. And I remember the Gibbs accelerator, or what was it called?
The Ascender.
Ascender, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if he'd invented it yet or not.
Pete Gibbs would definitely go on to make some amazing climbing gear, the Gibbs Ascender.
And then Waterman was just it seemed like he was from upstate New York, and somehow or other he got to Salt Lake and got into this whole thing. But yeah, it was it was kind of the start. They'd been doing it for a couple of years, but nobody had been doing that much, because obviously nothing started till 63 or till after 63. So
right with the dam, 10-day trip. Where was the trip going? Did it go all the way to Temple Bar?
Yes.
What was
We would spend the last night in Iceberg Canyon, I think, and then come on into the end.
That drive across the reservoir there must have been loud with the motor in the back and tedious, I guess, as the, well, I don't know. It's kind of neat country there.
Yeah. I mean, in retrospect, I don't recall it being unusually bad, because the river, I'm not sure how far the river took us, but in that last day from Iceberg is not that bad, but it definitely improved when they started coming out of Lee's Ferry. I mean, they're coming out at,
Pierce Ferry?
Pierce Ferry.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you would have known that country very well you were boating through. Is there anything else you remember about that 1969 river trip?
Nothing significant. I said it was an eye-opener for me and very fun, but nothing unusual other than just it really changed as far as going from just a very harsh trip to like a luxury trip. And that was, I think, part of what Bill was brought in to do, was to make it into more of a National Geographic type experience.
Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, just it was intended to be, you know, it's a camping trip, but with all the amenities as far as I think they had we added a sheet at the time, but anyway, it was a sleeping bag, but you had great meals, three good meals a day, and you waited on, and you know, all of this. The customers were not asked to help with the trip. Let's put it that way.
Okay. So more customers being catered to, if you will?
Yeah, I would say that.
Okay.
And that's one of the things we tried to do with the Sport Yak. The Sport Yak trip was supposed to be, everybody had to jump in and help with everything.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Did you see that trip in 69 going, maybe I could do this as employment?
Well, I think it was, but I'm not sure how it was presented to me, but the thought was, this is what we do, and I know we were planning to do Sport Yaks the next spring, but, you know, if that was, if that's what it was for me to meet Ron and Ron to see me, and or how that all fit together, I don't recall that part.
Okay.
But I know that at some point we were, Bill and I were talking about starting the Sport Yaks the next spring.
But you're on a quarter system in California.
Semester.
Oh, you were on a semester system. So, well, yeah. Even then, how did you get time off of that schooling, or did you just drop a semester to try to do this river thing?
No, I quit school in the summer of '68, and took a semester off. It was a Vista volunteer. And then, so I was a semester behind. So I was supposed to graduate in June of, or May of 70, but I didn't graduate till actually January of 71. So when I graduated in 71, the summer of 70, I didn't have anything to do, so I could go on a trip. And then graduated in January, so I was unemployed from, you know, February. So I think it was February, March, I left California and went to Canab.
Okay, hang on a second then. Let's back up. What's a Vista volunteer?
It's like a domestic peace corps.
Okay. What did you do?
I was what's called a community organizer, which I went to African-American community in Indianapolis. That's where they sent me. But it was a thing. It was during the Vietnam War, and you had to get, it wasn't, you had to get, anyway, when you were in college, you got an exemption, whatever it was called. But then, if you weren't in college, you had to get permission to do something. And so I asked, I said, this is like college, could I get it? They said, no. So I went, I quit midterm and went back to college.
Okay, because if you weren't enrolled in university, then you would be eligible for the draft for the Vietnam War? Is that how that was going?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. And then, so you did graduate. What was your degree? What did you graduate in 1971?
Philosophy.
Okay. And what were you thinking you were going to do with that degree, if anything, at that time?
I really wasn't. After I dropped out and went to be a Vista volunteer, it was right in the middle of the Vietnam War, and I was basically just a basket case. So when I came back, there was a professor that I knew who was a philosophy professor, and I basically went to him and said, I'm back, I want to graduate. And he said, well, come to philosophy, and I'll make sure you graduate.
Okay.
I really had no idea what I was going to do, no plans, and but I did want to, you know, obviously avoid the draft. I wanted to graduate.
Right.
But it was also one of those times when philosophy is what do you want to do with your life? What do you want? You know, what's the purpose for life? And so,
right.
Kind of those things when you're 20 years old to have the luxury to think about those kind of things.
And oftentimes it seems like the maturity of years helps form that. And 20 years in is not that many years in the game.
Yeah, but you think it is, you know. It's
right, you think it is. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So you graduated in January 71 and then went to Kanab. What was that like?
I said it was interesting. It was all young guys, but a couple of people like, I want to say Dale Waterman. It wasn't Dale, but it was whoever. I'm not sure if Ron was there full time, but there was lots of boatmen there, and so there was a bunkhouse, and we were building the boats, painting the boats, and getting everything ready for the spring. I don't remember if I went on a Dolores or Yampa trip. I think I did, and maybe even a Green River trip or a cataract trip. But then sometime in probably in June, that was my first trip down Desolation when this wind is 40 hertz.
Did in that spring of 71, did Grand Canyon Expeditions have their big warehouse then?
Yeah, that's what we were creating it there in Canal. They had purchased it or leased it or something, but they were building it out as far as making it into a.
And that was it was like the biggest building in all of Kanab, wasn't it?
Probably all of Southern Utah.
And what was it? It was just
old lumber mill.
Oh my! Okay. Was there a big sawdust burner thing there?
I don't recall that. It could have been, but
okay.
They were amazingly resourceful as far as they could build anything between welding and putting wood together and fiberglass. They built all kinds of stuff.
Was there a lot of wood still laying around from the lumber mill days?
I don't recall that.
Okay. Okay.
Right.
And Kanab in 1971 was, how can I put this tacitly? I think of it as being a strongly Mormon community.
Yeah, it was just one of those southern, or any one of an old Utah town, totally Mormon. Although it did have a little history, given the movie is history. There have been several movies made there over the years.
Okay.
So it was known in Hollywood at least, but it was totally Mormon.
And my running assumption is that the crew of people that had amassed there to run the river were not members of the church.
At least they weren't good. They were probably Jack Mormons, because Ron was a Mormon.
Okay.
And some of the others may have been at one time. D. Holliday had been a Mormon, but I could be wrong.
Okay. Had D started his company yet, or was he going to go out and do that?
I remember Holliday Expeditions, but I don't remember how, if that was later on or how that fit together with.
Okay.
He was a boatman in Cataract for Ron for at least a couple of years that I did it.
Okay. All right, and then you mentioned getting in on the Sport Yak boating in the Desolation Canyon, Desolation and Gray, in 71. What do you remember about that?
Well, it was 70. I think we started in 70.
Oh, in 1970. Okay.
Yeah. And I think we probably just had a couple of trips. So it, it was just an experimental thing where Bill had had done several trips, private trips in Sport Yaks to kind of make the boats more worthy. So they built splash shields on the front and the back, and they built a little container in the front where you could put stuff in, put your sleeping bag in and stuff.
Hmm.
It was supposed to be waterproof. So they had kind of perfected it, but then we put like 20 of them, and we would truck them up there. And I just remember the first trip, or maybe a couple of trips. We would put in sand, well, not sand wash, we put in at the...
Yeah, at sand the, wash.
Last time.
Oh.
But at the, where the road goes up quite a bit farther up river.
Up on the reservation, what's the name of that? In the Uinta Basin.
There's a bridge over the...
Yes.
Over the river, and that's where we would put in, and they would actually fly airplanes into there and drop people off, or they could. But I remember, and this is where I'm not, but I think that first year we'd put everything in there. They're probably all...
The mosquitoes would eat you guys alive.
Oh, it was unbelievable. It really was. But I remember we had a couple of charter trips. I'm not sure if we had any single trips or not, but we had a couple of charter ones, a couple of doctors out of San Diego and all their families and friends. And then I'm trying to think of what the other charter trip was. But then there was a Boy Scout troop from Red Oak, Iowa. Remember that? But this, 70 and 71, they kind of go together. So I'm not sure which were, which year they were.
Okay. So the idea was these people would learn on, what is it, 50 miles of flat water, something like that?
Not sure it was 50, but it was a lot. And these people never rode a boat in their lives. So to put them out there, make them row. And of course, in June, the water would move pretty fast, or at least it would move. But by the time you get to July, it's pretty dead. So there were a lot of unhappy people, and the first couple of days were just kind of torture. But and people were going, "What the hell am I doing?" But the truth is, it kind of, in a strange way, it was so miserable that they forgot who they were, where they came from, and were totally into just trying to survive. And so then, when you actually got into the canyon, it was a really unique experience, because whatever problems you had to, you were running away from, you'd forgotten all about them.
Wow.
It was really a life-changing experience for a lot of people, I think.
Very cool. And so were you in a sport yak, or were you in one of those rafts, the support raft?
I think I rode the big raft.
And that had coolers and all kinds of other, would have been a heavy boat in low water.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I mean, the river always kept moving, but it was not certainly not unbearable as far as that hard to row, but yeah, it was the support boat, which was the last boat, so it was good exercise.
Okay, so you're running sweep, you're picking up the stragglers. You had a problem in 1963 with the Orlocks and the Sport Yaks, like on day one. You'd mentioned that in an earlier interview. How did you fix that for the 1970-71 river seasons? What did you guys do to make that work better?
They put stronger wood on the side of on the gunnels attached to the boat, so it wasn't nearly as flexible. And then they had a round oar lock, I guess it would be. And then we put big rubber grips on the oars itself that would fit in the oar lock. And so you could still break them, but it was very unusual, because you could, if you had a rock, and the oar would just wasn't fixed anything, so it could pop in and out. And each boat we would take had a spare oar lock, with an oar lock in each boat. So we broke a few over the years, but there was never anything where we couldn't continue.
Okay. And how many people were typically on these trips?
I think there was about 20. I mean, it probably varied from 15 to 20, but it was,
okay.
There were, when you looked at the boats, there was a long line of boats.
Cool.
And again, some of these people never rode a boat in their life, so it was, they were going around in circles, and when you had to, they after a couple of days, they figured it out, but it was pretty amazing. That you could take somebody who'd never been in a boat before in their life, never rode a boat, and within 4 days be having them run the rapids.
Wow. And there are some in Desolation and Gray Canyons, there are some fun rapids in there.
Yeah, I mean, they're relative to the size of a sport yak, they're still not like Grand Canyon, like the biggest Crystal or something, but or Lava, but you could certainly flip a boat.
Yeah, size proportionally.
Depending on high water, too, in the spring when it was really high, there was one year, I know, when I was there, they had a Boy Scout troop that got wrapped up, and I think Boy Scout drowned. Or one or two of them drowned. So every year there was somebody would die in there.
Okay. Okay. And of course, everybody was wearing life jackets, I'm assuming?
Yeah, you had to wear life jackets. And again, it's late May and June, the water because the Apu was not dammed, would go high by 20,000 feet or so. But then by July, it would start to come down, and in August and September, it was you know, 1,000 feet or a couple of thousand feet. But that's when it was really fun, because it was, you know, big sandy beaches and lots of driftwood, and we used to make big fires at night, and we actually would make like saunas where we would take a couple of boats and stand them up or put them on their sides and then cover them with tarps and take hot rocks and put them in a big fire and make eat the rocks real hot and then put them inside in the tent and then throw water on them and make a sauna.
Huh.
We had lots of fun.
Very fun. Anything else you remember about those trips? Why, you know, and were you thinking, okay, well, I'm going to make a career at this, or what happened to send you in a new direction?
Well, that was kind of the thing was, I never really thought of it as a career, but in looking around, people were making it a career. A lot of people would, you know, work in the snow ski guides or something in the winter, and then the river guides in the summer, which was a legitimate career, but you know, that didn't seem that exciting to me. So after I graduated from college, did the first year in the summer up there. Then I came back and I painted houses in the winter in Las Vegas, and then went back. But that's when I was painting houses here. That's when I decided to apply to law school. So I applied to law school, went back up there.
Where did you apply?
I applied all over the place, but amazingly, one of the houses I was painting, they got friendly with the woman who hired me, and she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm applying to law school. And she said, well, you ought to apply to where my husband's from, the University of Denver. And I never even heard of the school, but I ended up, based on her recommendation, I applied, because actually a lot of people from Las Vegas had gone there, because we didn't have a law school in Nevada at the time.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah.
So not even at Reno. There. Huh.
So I applied there, and everywhere else, I think I had been turned down, and I was on the waiting list, but I'd really forgotten about it. And this would have been the summer of 72, I guess. And so I was in working, they had a house in Green River, a bunkhouse kind of thing. And I just remember getting a notice saying, you know, you've been accepted and show up in 2 weeks.
Wow. To Denver.
Yeah.
Huh. And, you know, this is kind of a pivotal sort of deal. Did you meet any lawyers that said, you know, Tick, you might want to consider law school? You know, actually having a degree in philosophy means you're sort of thinking about societal rules and regulations and concepts of how civilizations work or don't work, in a broad brush kind of way. But what was it that steered you toward law?
The reality is, when you have a degree in philosophy, there's not much else you can do, frankly. you can run rivers, or you can teach philosophy, or you can go to law school. So, one of the options. My father was a judge, even though he was an artist. He'd been made the judge in Boulder City, so I had a little legal background. But
wait a minute, I missed that. I think you mentioned that, but I don't think I opened that up much. Was he? I mean, this is like a small claims court kind of position.
Yeah, he was justice of the peace and municipal judge, but basically traffic tickets and you know, yeah, you're right as far as all claims, those kind of things.
Would he marry people?
Yeah, that's one thing we did, was he'd marry people at our house. Well, he'd go other places too, but we used to marry people at our house, and you had to have two witnesses, and each one got paid $1, so. Over the years,
Whoa! Okay. And did you spend some time in court just kind of watching what was going on, watching what your dad was doing?
No, never did.
Okay.
I went to law school having no idea what a lawyer does, or you know, just, it was something to, try, and but it was very random.
Did your dad at the dinner table at night talk with your mom about, well, I had an interesting, you know, case in court today, so-and-so, you know, was charged with running a red light, but then said they didn't do it because blah, blah.
You know, I think, I'm not sure if he became a judge after I left, went to college. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not even sure that never was an issue. I just remember when I was staying at home, which wasn't that much, being a witness when they would marry people.
Okay. So packed up your bags and moved to Denver. Had you been to Denver before?
Never. No. I mean, it was actually very interesting to come from the river and, you know, go right to being at law school.
Tell me about that. What do you mean?
Well, just it was a, you know, obviously a kind of a change. Environment and everything, from being outside in open spaces, you know, sleeping under the stars, to trying to, you know, read books and do it all. But it seemed to work out. I wasn't a great student or anything, but I passed.
Okay.
If you don't know what you want to do with your life, go to law school, because you're a success just by saying you're going to law school. Everybody's. It's a signal that you're acceptable, and at the end of the day, you learn a hell of a lot about a lot of different things.
Yeah, when I think about law school, I think of all different types of law. I mean, there's just a phenomenal amount of types of law. It's like medicine. There's so many different types of medicine. Was the University of Denver, was it well known for any one specific type of law, and did you get an emphasis in that, or was it pretty general back then?
No, it was pretty gentle. They did have a good environmental program, which at the time I thought, well, great, I'll be an environmental lawyer. But then I quickly realized that environmental lawyers basically work for oil companies. Aren't too many Sierra Club positions.
Okay. So you would basically be a working environmental law for the industry.
Right. I'm trying to ruin the environment.
So did you go into that program, or was that just sort of an emphasis you could take classes in?
Yeah, I don't even know how much I must have taken some environmental law classes, but there was not like a separate program or anything.
Was that a quarter program or a semester program?
That's a good question. I think it had to be quarters, because I know we, the first year I was there, we had finals were due like we're in early December, so I think it was quarters.
Okay. And how long was the program?
It's 3 years.
Wow.
But I think we could. You could go during the summer and then graduate early. So I think I graduated like a quarter early. And the other thing that you could do there, you could take the bar exam your last semester, your last quarter.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I took the bar exam in Denver or in Colorado while I was still in school.
So that allows you to defend people in court, but just in the state of Colorado, is that right? Or is that, does the bar exam allow you to practice nationwide?
No, it's just Colorado or D.C. D.C. will waive you in if you belong to a state.
Okay. And did you, those 3 years, did you work during that time for, you know, to help with the expenses of your schooling?
I did. You know, John and Lori and her husband John lived pretty far from where I live. So, and John got me a job with, it was a government, it was the EEOC, it was, I don't know if it was the Environmental Protection Agency or something, but something where, to a friend of John's where I had a part-time job.
So you were going to school and working at the same time, which adds to the workload.
Well, not hard. It was more of just something to keep busy. I lived up in the mountains and didn't go to school that much.
Okay. And then Loie, of course, is Bill Belknap's daughter and Buzzy Belknap's sister.
Right.
And that's John Evans, is that right?
Right.
What do you remember about John and Loie?
Just, you know, the nicest people in the world. You know, he was a big-time mountain climber, and I must have been the last year I worked on the river. She was a river guide, too, so she and I don't know if we did trips together, or we did trips. I don't remember I don't remember at least one trip we did together, so we probably teamed up together.
Okay.
But, I was there when their daughter was born, when I was in Moscow, and we were babysitting for them for that.
Cool.
Probably their first babysitter.
Oh, fun. Okay. And then, so three-year program, it graduated in 1975?
75, yeah.
Then what did you do?
Then moved to D.C., and it was getting ready for our presidential cycle, and the one thing I always had been interested in was politics. So
wait a minute. Back up. What got you interested in politics?
It's just something that my mother was a government teacher, and so we were always talking about politics.
Okay.
So, but truthfully, I'd never really been that involved. When I was in law school, I worked for a guy that ran for the U.S. Senate.
Who was that? Do you remember his name?
Marty Miller. He ran against Gary Hart in the primary. This would have been probably, I'm sure it was 74. And anyway, so I got to travel around Colorado a lot in that election, especially Western Colorado, the rural Colorado. But he lost to Gary Hart, and then Gary Hart won in the general. But anyway, so I got to see a lot of the politics, and then thought, well, this is going to be great to go to D.C. And anyway, it was the time of my life to try that, and so I went there and discovered that getting a job, a legal job in Washington, D.C. was not that simple.
Ooh. Hang on a second. Before we leave your campaign working for Marty Miller, I had a question for you about Gary Hart, which you might know if you were in the law circles there in Colorado or not. There was a lawyer named Jerry Hart. His nickname was Geronimo. He was a brilliant lawyer. And he worked, had his own law firm there in Denver. And I wondered if Gary was related in any way to Jerry.
I doubt it. Gary Hart's name actually was Hart Pence. He had changed it to Hart.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so there's a thank you. That clears that up for me entirely. Because Jerry Hart knew Doc Marston, boated with Marston in the Grand Canyon in the 70s. Marston helped him get into the Bohemian Club. And he was out of Denver, and he was just again a brilliant man. Amazing lawyer. So, and I always thought, that last name. So thank you for clearing that up.
Yeah, so Hart had, worked for McGovern. I think he was McGovern's campaign manager. And then after McGovern lost in 72, he moved to Denver and ran for Senate. And ended up running again. I think it was Domenici was the old-time Republican senator who everybody thought was invincible, and Gary Hart, just being a nobody, came in and knocked him off. So It was pretty amazing.
Interesting. And so you got your, you passed the bar exam, and you mentioned it allowed you to work in D.C. as well. But was it politics that then took you to D.C. to try to kind of work that scene?
You know, I'm not even sure it was so much politics. It was didn't want to come home, didn't want to actually practice law, and so.
Were they hiring there?
No, I didn't really know that at the time, so I was just, I'm flexible. I was married, but I didn't have, we didn't have any kids or anything, so we went to D.C. to see what was up there. And,
okay, wait a minute. Now I need to back up again. Who did you marry? What was her name? Or, you know, what was her name? And how did you guys meet?
Met at college, and then, married in, that's a good question. The summer, probably summer of 73, I guess, after first year of law school.
So you both met in Denver?
No, met at Pomona, an undergraduate.
Oh, so met in California.
Yeah. And.
And what's your partner's name?
Well, this was not my partner at the time, but I mean not anymore. But her name was Marilyn Smith.
Okay.
So anyway, we were young, didn't have any responsibilities, and. Didn't want to go back to Nevada, California, and do anything. So I could just go to D.C. It couldn't be that hard.
Okay. And how did? And so this would have been in the summer of 75?
Right. Actually, the spring of 75. Because I graduated a quarter.
Ah,
so.
Right.
March of 75, probably.
And what did you do in D.C.?
Well, I tried to get a job, and frankly, couldn't find anything worth. A real job, so I was not even a well-paid intern, but an intern on the Capitol Hill working for what's called the Environmental Study Group, which was a division of the kind of a little offshoot in the House of Representatives.
Okay.
But it was not a big time job, so that's when I started looking at presidential. Politics, saying if I'm not going to do anything, I might as well look at presidential politics. And I looked at all the presidential candidates and liked, and I had a connection with Carter, and really just thought, really looking at him closely, he was by far the sharpest tool in the toolbox.
Okay.
I had to figure out a way to hook up with him, and they hired me, and the rest is history.
So Carter would go ahead and win that election in November of 76, if I get this right, if my timeline is right. What were you hired as, and what did you do?
Well, I started out just working in Pennsylvania back in 75, and then... worked all the way until November in his campaign, and then after he was elected...
Don't go too fast through this.
Okay.
So you were hired in D.C., and they shipped you to Pennsylvania. What were you doing in Pennsylvania?
I was organizing for the Pennsylvania primary, which was in April. And I was set there in December. So I honestly, he was so far down the polls, not even in the polls, the thought that I would even get to see the guy or see a presidential campaign in April was pretty remote. But anyway, that was what was offered to me, and I took it.
Okay.
And it turned out that Pennsylvania
Hang on. I'm thinking these days, you know, there's going to be some, of course, everything's televised, and it was televised then. There's going to be some forums where the candidates can all, you know, kind of talk about their stuff. And this is going to be, again, this is going to be the primary. Who was Carter running against?
Everybody and their uncle. So it was Mo Udall.
Wow.
And Henry Jackson out of Washington State. And the governor of Pennsylvania was running.
Oh, my.
There were like 10 candidates.
Well, so when they sent you to Pennsylvania, were they assuming that he was going to lose Pennsylvania? I mean, I don't mean to point blank kind of put you on the spot here, but were you aware? Because with the governor of the state, the sitting governor running, anybody who's going to run against the sitting governor, that's going to be a tough row to hoe.
Well, again, you have to understand presidential politics, but in Pennsylvania, you had to get delegates qualified and on the ballot in January to be able to win delegates in April.
Okay.
So that was my initial job was to go out and find people to run as Carter delegates in 50 state senate districts, and that was a challenge in itself because no one knew who Jimmy Carter was, and so the normal people who would want to be a delegate had already signed up with one of these other people, they were smart enough to see that, you know, you had to do this early, and so they were organized and they hired me, and we had people there and one of his classmates from the Naval Academy, so we were out there doing this early on, and then you know, as he started to win, he won Iowa, he won New Hampshire, and then you can see that, you know, wait a minute, this might actually happen. And so I just stayed in Pennsylvania, you know, starting to get the campaign up and organized, although it was, you know, just a couple of us trying to do that. And then it turned out that the Pennsylvania primary was the big primary. So it just happened by happenstance, be sitting in the middle of a pretty amazing election.
And so he won Pennsylvania.
Right.
Convincingly.
Yeah, and that was the big, really the big showdown. But when he won that, it was pretty much he wasn't guaranteed he was going to win, but it was pretty much he was going to win. Then later on, then Jerry Brown jumped in from California, and there was a battle out here in the West. But the truth is, when he won Pennsylvania, that was the big one.
So when did you first meet President Carter? Well, as he would become president. When did you first meet him?
You know, I honestly don't know. I mean, I didn't. I met the people around him, but I don't know that I even shook his hand until April of 76.
Okay. And after he won Pennsylvania, did you stay with the Carter campaign?
I did. Then I came out west and worked in Utah and Nevada, and then came back and worked in Ohio, and then after the primaries were over, went to Atlanta, where the national headquarters was, worked in the national headquarters.
And Marilyn's going with you as you're traveling around?
No, she stayed in D.C.
Oh, she did?
Yeah.
Okay, what was she doing there?
She was working for a political firm, a polling firm.
Okay.
But that was really why we ended up being divorced. It was just, but it was one of those things where we were separated and it wasn't gonna be.
Oh, that's okay. And when did you get divorced then?
The summer of 77.
Okay. So then to Atlanta, for the national office, and did you stay there? What were your duties there? I mean, I've never talked to anybody before that actually was on a winning presidential, campaign. So I'm like, all right, Tick, tell me more about this. in Atlanta, what did you do there?
I was basically what they call the field staff. So we were, you have to hire and set up a campaign in all 50 states.
Okay.
So it was just basically hiring a campaign manager for each state and hiring staff and just gave the campaign what they call the field campaign, which is the door-to-door and all that stuff.
Did you have any mentors helping you with this?
Oh yeah, I was working for the guy that I was closest to was named Tim Kraft, who was sent into Pennsylvania to end up being the Pennsylvania campaign manager. So I was his deputy back in April, and then he was my mentor as far as he would pull me along wherever he went. And he ended up being the national field director. So I was one of his assistants in Atlanta.
What do you remember about him?
I still talk to him a lot. So he was, Carter was, we had some unusual people because Carter, you know, was not super well known. So he, all the national campaign people that would normally gravitate towards presidential politics and then be with a presidential candidate or the winner had already been picked. So Carter was left hiring just people who no one else knew. And he had hired two people out of New Mexico, probably early 75. One of them he sent to Iowa, which is Tim Kraft. And the other one he sent to New Hampshire, named Chris Brown. And both of them, you know, were just not flashy people, but understood how to get along with people, knew the mechanics, and just you know, ended up winning. I mean, it was truthfully Carter himself, it was his personality and his organizational skills that did it. But you know, there were people that had to be involved in putting it all together, and Tim was one of those early people, as early as you can get, other than his team from Atlanta. And so he was sent to, he won Iowa, which was the first event, so he became a star, and then you know, went to different states, including mainly Pennsylvania.
Okay. And who was Carter running against?
You know, again, it's at my memory, but there were so many people.
Well, no, in the general election, I was thinking.
Oh, the general. I'm sorry. Okay, yeah, that was definitely Jerry Ford, the President Ford.
Got it. Okay. Sorry, I'm showing my political ignorance here. And so were you helping like to get people to knock on doors and pass out, you know, information?
Well, the higher level, we were hiring. I said the campaign manager. Each state had to have a campaign manager, deputy campaign manager. So it was more, you know, than in Atlanta. It was the coordinating the 50 states essentially.
Okay.
And basically, that was Tim's job, but I was, you know, one of several people who were assistants to him, trying to do all this. It's a pretty amazing task when you think about it.
And did you stick with that through election night, November 1976?
Yeah, actually, the very last 2 weeks, I went to Wisconsin. Everybody left the headquarters, went to different states. I went to Wisconsin. I was in Wisconsin. When he won, but then went back to Atlanta after the election and stayed there, and then went to D.C. I'm sure probably before Christmas to you know, arguably try to organize the White House or something. I'm not sure what we were supposed to be doing, but.
And did you get a job then with the administration?
I did, but it was a temporary job. So I was hired be in the White House personnel office, and specifically assigned to try to help people who had worked in the campaign get jobs in the administration.
Okay.
But it turns out there aren't that many. There's only like 2,000 jobs that are political jobs to start with. So there were a lot more people we were trying to place than there were positions.
Okay. Yeah, sort of assume, you know, everybody in that campaign is going to get a job, but clearly they don't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they all think they are. And the truth was, most of them were, I mean, the positions in D.C. are very high level. You know, the resumes we were looking at were phenomenal.
Wow.
And the people that were coming from outside, the Carter campaign people, were all just kids that went to work for him just because they wanted to work for him, but they didn't have the backgrounds to really work in D.C. So a lot of them got to stick around, but a lot of them just wasn't able to do.
It's almost like you need a staff to help you get elected, and then you got to fire all those people and hire a whole bunch of new people that can run a government.
Right. But the trick is, of course, to have some kind of a interface so you have people around you who are loyal. Because politics is very fickle, and the best and the brightest may not know who you are or give a shit about you. So you got to have a group of people around you that are believe in you, and you know them. So if you can, I was like one level away from that group of people, but I knew all the staff people around the president.
Okay. Yeah.
I was in it with him so long, so it was very fun for me. But at the end of the day, I wasn't going to end up staying at the White House, so I left D.C. and came back to Nevada.
And that was January 1977?
No, it was in the summer of 77. I stayed there for about 6 months after he was locked in.
Okay, back to Nevada. This is the summer 1977. You know, Tick, this sounds like a good place to put a comma in this interview series, but I do want to ask you one last question now with President Jimmy Carter in hospice at home, not expected to live, I think, through the week.
It was sort of funny, though. I was reading something once. Somebody said that when Carter decided to go to hospice, and this is a joke, but this is how Carter thinks. He talked to people and said, well, how long is the longest anyone's ever lived arrived in hospice? Because he's so competitive, he wants to outlive everybody.
Well, he might do it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, I honestly don't know what his status is. Obviously, he's dying, but he could die today, but he could also last a while.
People can last a while on hospice. You're exactly right. But I wanted to ask you your thoughts now, looking back today in February 2023, to what Jimmy Carter did for the country as a statesman and politician. Could you speak to that a little bit?
it's tough to summarize real quickly, but you'd have to go back to the time when he was there, because, we just thrown Nixon out. Ford, who was his vice president, came in, but was kind of incompetent. But there was, in the country itself, there was a large distrust of government, and his big thing was, I've never tell a lie, and he carried his own suitcase by getting out of there first one and back. And he really threw away the imperial presidency. And then if you look at his actual record as when he was president, it's phenomenal what he did. One of the things that no one at the time appreciated was his vision of where we were going. He put the solar panels on the White House. He created the Department of Energy. He created the Department of Education. He really was into making government work. But he was just stuck with Nixon had put on price controls. When those came off, you know, inflation just started taking over.
Mm.
And so he was ended up just being stuck with this huge inflation that he kept asking people, what can I do? And everybody had these ideas. None of them would work. He ended up hiring Paul Volcker to run the Fed, and Volcker just said, if you want to do it, we'll do it. But he could put interest rates.
Hey, Tick, I'm sorry. You were breaking up there. You mentioned Paul Volcker and interest rates. Can you go over that again?
Yeah, so he put Volcker in charge of the Fed, and Volcker, you know, the time-honored way to get rid of inflation is just to raise interest rates.
Right.
Like we're doing now. And to the point where the economy stops, and then the inflation dies out. And that's what he did. He went up to like 20%. And I remember when I bought my first house, mortgage rates were 12.5%. And you ended up owing, after 5 years, you owed more on your mortgage than you did when you started.
Hmm.
So anyway, that really crushed everything. And then, of course, the things in Iran. But going back to the point was, if you just look at his record and what he tried to do and what he did do, he's definitely looked at a lot better now than he was. And then, of course, after his presidency, then people actually, when you look at how he continued to work and make the world better.
It's an amazing legacy of a servant, a public servant, is how I think of him.
A lot of things just are out of your control, and
right.
Inflation was one of those.
But
no one. There were no wars started while he was there. He just did a lot of phenomenal stuff, and so even after just 4 years, it was. But the truth is, he was an outsider. And all the people around him, including me, were people were not like old Washington hands or anything. It was close to a revolution as you're ever going to have in this country, probably.
Wow, that's a fascinating statement again going back to Carter's abilities as an individual to coordinate all that and to bring in people around him to do that. Very cool. Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's been very fun for me, just, you know, I shouldn't say fun, but reading about everybody's remembrance of him since he announced he was going to hospice, you know, and all this, these good things that no one ever talks about or everybody's talking about now, so it's very...
Yeah. Yeah, the stuff that he's done that nobody's aware of. Yeah. Tick, is there anything else you would like to mention in this interview series we've just covered here that I didn't ask you about?
No, I think I'm not sure why you want to keep going on this stuff, but I'm happy to keep talking.
Okay, well, very good.
Great for me to kind of think through things that I'd forgotten about for 40 years.
Interesting, okay. Well, with that, this will conclude part 3 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Tick Siegerbloom. My name is Tom Martin. Today is Sunday, February 26th, 2023. And Tick, thank you so very much.
Thank you.